Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone, I just dropped my pen, sorry.
Okay, well I'll pad for you, Pete. It's the 29th of June and this is episode 66. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to Steve Globerman, one of the big people over at the Fraser Institute in Canada.
One of our favourite Canadians.
Yes, out of a crowded field. So we're going to be talking to him about the book that the IPA has helped out with, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population.
That was good.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're going to be talking about small business startup rates, why that's so important, and a few stories from Canada that have made the news, including the Ontario elections.
Which a lot of listeners are interested in.
Yes, and the trade war thing between the US and Canada. We'll get his take on that. We're also going to be talking to IPA research fellow Matthew Lesh about his parliamentary research brief that came out this week talking about the corporate tax rate cuts. Sorry, but
big week for Matt.
Big week for Matthew. He does not like Matt.
Doesn't he?
You keep calling him Matt, and I'm trying to tell you.
He's never told me.
Yeah.
Sorry, Matthew.
Okay, cool. Sorry, but first things first, thank you to everyone who's donated to the IPA's end of financial year campaign. You've still got 2 days when we're recording this, or whenever you're listening to this, you've got a few days left to donate to it. You can go to ipa.org.au/EOFY if you want to donate. Everything the IPA does is only possible with support of our members and donors. So if you like what we're doing, please get involved, help us out, and we can get even bigger and better and keep promoting freedom.
Thank you for all your support. And don't let this podcast be, you know, a deciding factor on whether or not you donate. We do other stuff as well.
We do. Cool. But that is good. I like the podcast.
That was not the point of my...
Yeah. Anyway. Cool. Let's get into it. So we'll talk about this parliamentary research brief. So corporate tax cuts have been a huge story in Australia the last few weeks. And what Matthew Lesh has done this week is talk about the proposed Treasury Laws Amendment Enterprise Tax Plan Number 2. I'd work on that title if I'm the Liberal Party.
It's wordy, isn't it?
It's wordy. Doesn't really fit well on a T-shirt. So people can't really get around it. But the important thing is it is reducing corporate tax cuts, corporate tax rates from 30% to 25% over the next few years. So Matthew's going to be, his parliamentary research brief is about why that's going to be so important and why the myth that big business isn't paying its fair share of tax and therefore we should be increasing taxes. He sort of dispels that myth.
Mm-hmm.
We won't go too heavily into the parliamentary research brief because we are talking about it with Matthew later in the show.
Yes.
But stuff has happened since that parliamentary research brief has come out.
Stuff has happened.
Yes. Causation? I'm going to say yes.
Well, my first thought was that they hadn't read Matthew's parliamentary research brief for the Labor Party when they released their response.
Well, it's a captain's call from Bill Shorten, but we'll get into that. So Bill Shorten this week announced that he would reverse legislated company tax cuts for businesses between a $10 and $50 million turnover.
So, and plus 50 million plus. Everyone over $10 million.
Yeah, so everyone over $10 million. But when you break down that $10 to $50 million turnover, that's when things get really interesting. So Matthew Lesh also put out a media release yesterday talking about that. So here's how many people actually get affected when that happens. So 1.5 million workers in Australia are employed in businesses between 10 and 50 million in turnover. And additionally, 3.68 million workers are employed in businesses with over $50 million in turnover. And all of these people are going to miss out because of Labor's rejection of the corporate tax cuts.
And James, do you know how many, what percentage of the Australia's workforce that makes up?
I do not, Pete.
About half.
That's not a percentage, Pete. That is a rough estimate.
Oh.
I thought that was a cold, hard stat. I thought we were all going to learn a fact.
Well, that's Matthew's stat, is that 50%, half.
No.
Approximately half.
Oh, Pete. Come back with the
which
stat.
Which is important.
Yeah, it is very important. So 5.25 million people are worse off because of Bill Shorten's reversal on the plan. If Labor gets in power and they reverse these tax cuts, 5.25 million Australian workers are going to be let off. So I wait, Pete, for the Australian Labor movement, or the union movement, to come out against Bill Shorten on this one.
Well, so do I, James. Well, and we'll see.
We will see. Something interesting this morning was Anthony Albanese was not really endorsing that captain's call by Bill Shorten.
It was controversial.
It was very controversial. A bit of Albo momentum this morning.
Is that a thing?
It's the thing I said this morning.
Thank God it's not actually a thing. But do you know one of the things I hate in politics the most?
Go.
Captain's call.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be so humiliating for the shadow cabinet or the cabinet. Just why am I here?
No, just the word.
Oh, the captain's call. Oh, so not the concept of a leader saying, right, this is our policy. Yeah. It's like, hey, this is a captain's call.
It's just one of those things that a journo's come up with and everyone's like, oh, that sounds smart. Anyway.
And they run with it.
Carry on, James.
Well, I was going to say, so it'd be interesting to see if Labor goes back on this reversal to bring it to the original. I don't know. What, 180 on a 180? Is that a zero? Probably.
You're asking the wrong bloke.
Okay, cool. Where's my stat, Pete?
50% is the stat.
Cool. So it'd be interesting to see what Labor does with that. So, yeah, if you want to read more about that, so Matthew's media release is online on our website, and so is his parliamentary research brief. And like mm-hmm. I said, we are going to be talking a bit more about corporate tax rates with Matthew later in the show, but we should move on. Pete, do you want to yes. talk about climate change?
Yes, I love climate change.
Well, hey, well, no, well, unpack that.
I just love you everything
love
about it.
The study of climate change.
I love it when, you know, it's winter now, and I hope the climate changes soon and gets warmer.
I'll say.
Okay, so a report last week from the Climate Action Network in Europe called Off Target, Ranking of EU Countries' Ambition and Progress in Fighting Climate Change.
And Liberal Party, you're going to go Enterprise Tax Plan Number 2, Treasury Laws Amendment. What mm-hmm. was the first word of that one?
Off Target.
There we go. Done. All right, take note.
And James, you would have seen that on the front cover of the report is a picture of these little guys playing soccer. Because they're missing the target.
Oh, that's smart.
And there's
smart.
A soccer tournament on at the moment. So
the
that
animation's
was good.
Working well there.
Climate Action Network of Europe are fantastic. Anyway, the key takeout of this report is...
It wasn't the soccer players.
The key takeout wasn't the soccer players. No, it was that contributions proposed at the Paris talks are nowhere near close enough to keep temperature rise below the threshold. All EU countries are off target. Every single one, they are failing to increase their climate action in line with the Paris Agreement goal. No single EU country is performing sufficiently in both ambition and progress in reducing carbon emissions. So isn't that funny, James, that you know the wonderful leaders of the EU that are leading the charge against climate change aren't meeting their goals, and in fact, carbon dioxide emissions have gone up 2.5% in 2017, and evil Donald Trump, who eats baby dolphins for breakfast, has overseen the United States in 2017, where emissions actually fell 0.5%.
Well, that's very interesting. So, yeah, I think this is the first time in human history that a government has made a huge announcement that they're going to do something and then not follow through. So, yeah. Shocking to see that the EU as well. I can't believe that.
No. Australia, of course, is on target. So, that's great.
Yes.
Thank God Australia's doing that.
Yeah. So 23 out of 28 European member states. So, none of them are meeting it, but I like the specific facts. Take note, Pete. 23 out of 28 European member states score poorly. So, that is really bad. But one thing they are not failing to do, Pete, is increase the cost of energy, as we discussed on last week's show. If you want to read more about that, we link to it in Hay. We'll move on to another topic. We're running a bit late here. But big talking point in America this week. This
huge.
Bizarre story. There's a whole lot of stuff to talk about here. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Donald Trump's press secretary, the person that fronts the media.
What a middle name.
Well, it's...
That's what's been missed in all this.
Yeah. Huckabee.
Mm.
Is that particularly interesting too?
It's just like saying it.
All right, cool. So White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders claimed on Saturday she was thrown out of a restaurant because she works for Donald Trump.
Yes.
She tweeted, "Last night I was told by the owner of Red Hen in Lexington, Virginia to leave because I work for the President of the United States and I politely left. Her actions say far more about her than about me." So a lot of things to discuss here. One I found initially interesting was that she was thrown out halfway through the meal.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's adding insult to injury.
That hurts it's like, as well.
You didn't get to the chips. You're still halfway through the burger.
They did give it on the house, though, I noticed.
Okay, that's interesting. To take it seriously, you should be able to do this. I think, you know, like the concept of a business owner deciding whether or not they're going to serve customers.
Yeah.
Like, that should be happening. It's not great. Like, I'm not loving the fact that she was thrown out. I don't love anyone being thrown out of a restaurant. But the idea that you are... told to give someone service is not cool.
Yeah, philosophically, we'd have no problem with this, James.
Yes. But the interesting point there is the link to the gay wedding cake stuff, the huge story from a few weeks ago, whether or not the owner of a bakery should be forced to make a cake for a gay wedding couple.
Yeah, well, the hypocrisy is obvious.
Yes, exactly. I did like The Independent, a website in the UK, actually ran an article, "Why It's Okay to Tell Sarah Sanders to Leave a Restaurant, but Not Okay to Refuse Someone a Gay Wedding Cake."
Yep.
So that is having a cake and eating it too.
Oh.
But literally though, anyway, I like this. So this is a byline of the article. Subheading. "One courageous act in order not to seem complicit in controversial political decisions is not the same as accepting someone protesting against the existence of somebody else."
Okay.
That's not how I interpreted either of those things. I do love the idea that, like, if you make Sarah Huckabee Sanders lunch, you are... What was the phrasing? complicit in controversial political decisions.
Yeah, I saw that. I
like,
feel like
it, merely providing her with food is like, I have agreed with every single part of her worldview.
Yeah, I did see the quote from the restaurant owner who was like, you know, it just felt like a moment in time. It wasn't.
It was.
It was lunch. But anyway, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Up to her what she does with her restaurant.
Yeah, is it, by that logic, is any interaction with someone on the other political aisle that isn't screaming you selling out your cause?
Well, that's the
that's the only thing I can say.
That's right.
And then that started to open up a wider debate about civility in politics.
Yeah, yeah.
About a few days later, you had Maxine Waters, who's a Democrat congresswoman from California. She's at a rally, and she's talking to the crowd, and she says, and if you see anybody from that cabinet, Trump's cabinet, in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd, and you push back on them, and you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
She looks completely deranged in that video. She
does not look happy.
And, we
and the crowd is like really into this.
Yeah,
no
yeah,
one
yeah.
like, well, that's a bit far. Everyone's like, that's awesome.
There's a you're right. And we linked to an ad in a Republican ad in Hay yesterday, which covered a lot of this stuff, including that speech, which all put together was quite a powerful picture about
the
rage in America on the left.
Yeah, it's a weird one because it's like, things seem really bad, but the idea is like, this isn't how we used to do debates in America. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it is. Like, I'm pretty sure that's how people do debates everywhere.
Yeah, like America has this peaceful past.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, you know, long-time listeners or part-time listeners of the show would know I'm a big basketball fan, but it's like, you know, there was restaurants that players couldn't go to in the 70s because they'd just get chucked out. Like, this is a thing that's always happened.
Why
Well, because they were black.
Oh, but, racially?
Yeah,
in the 70s? Wow, that's terrible.
You know, it's a terrible thing that happens, but it's always happened. But yeah, I guess, well, it's sort of like the effect of social media on politics. Like, this is just a story 20 years ago, but it's now national news all the time that Sarah Sanders gets put out of a restaurant.
And weren't you telling me yesterday that this has raised a whole lot of safety issues for a number of pollies?
Yeah, so the interesting one is, like, I could be wrong here. I'm pretty sure I'm right, but it's never stopped me before. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders now has Secret Service, which isn't something that the press secretary usually has to people to guard her. And you think, like, you know, 17 years ago it was 9/11 when things were very tense and still the press secretary wasn't given Secret Service. So,
there we do.
Yeah, so these must be some really credible threats about safety and violence to make that happen, which is, you know, pretty disconcerting.
It is.
Pete, anyway, let's talk Brexit.
Brexit. Okay, so the two-year anniversary of Brexit was on the 23rd of June earlier this week. What day is it?
The 29th of June, so yes, earlier this week.
Yeah, very good. Now, that means it was last Saturday.
Oh.
Anyway.
Hang on.
So,
calendar week? Last 7 days.
So it's the 29th.
Look, recently.
Yeah, within the last 7 days.
Yeah.
Was the two-year anniversary of Brexit. Not Brexit. Yeah, Brexit. Where, obviously, you know what Brexit is.
Yeah.
Anyway, Spectator ran a story with the six worst predictions of Brexit. Now, I'm not going to go through all of them because I think you should read it for yourself. But my two favourite were, and I love this the most because I remember when I was there, not there, but in Australia, how many people said to me, Peter, do you know how bad this is going to be for the economy? As if, like, you know, this issue of sovereignty, you know, let's accede sovereignty for marginal economic improvement. Anyway.
Well, in their defense, Brexit did say we're not going to trade anymore with any country ever. Like, that was one of the hallmark things. I'm not being serious.
I was like, I don't think that's a thing, but you were being sarcastic. Okay, yeah. No, very good. So, anyway, Goldman Sachs, wonderful Goldman Sachs, they predicted a recession by 2017, which didn't occur. And also, the Treasury in the United in the UK predicted 500,000 job losses, and they were very specific. They were like, in Wales, it's going to be 43,000 job losses. And in Scotland, there's going to be 24,000 job losses. All this stuff, there has been a 43-year low in unemployment in the UK and a 30-year high in manufacturing. So I just would like to go back to a few of my mates who said to me, Peter, do you realise how bad this is going to be for the economy? And say, actually, mate, you were wrong.
Yeah, and also the companies that are predicting this, like Goldman Sachs surely has to take a big loss for saying that. But
well,
they don't apologise.
They donated to the stay cause.
But it's the kind of thing where
they probably thought it was in their interest.
Yeah, yeah. But it's the kind of thing, like, you see this all around the media, and see this with, you know, lobby groups and stuff, where they keep on predicting the end of the world, they keep on predicting the end of the world, and then you just have regular people looking around them saying, I don't see what I'm being told to see. And then that just phases out when they talk about stuff in elections. So
yeah, but
that's,
it gives us lots of podcast material.
It does. So keep it coming.
Yeah.
Keep these apocalyptic things coming. Cool. So that's all we got. Oh, so we'll run through a quick idea of what the IPA has been up to this week.
Yes,
so obviously, a lot of corporate tax stuff. We're going to be talking to Les later in the show. You can go on our website. But also on our website this week, so John Roskam had an article in the Australian Financial Review this morning talking about, well, corporate tax again. So talking about how Labor's treating it. So you can go to that. Class divide, that's too wide. We also had Matthew Lesh again, huge week for Matthew, in the Australian talking about the university regulator, the Tertiary Education Quality Standards Agency, or TEQSA, has lost its way into political matters. It's talking about campus censorship and freedom of speech and academic inquiry. So you can read that on our website. You also got Daniel Wilde in the Daily Telegraph on, I want to say, Wednesday. I'm not really good at maths, but power policy prioritizes expensive green goals. So talking about power and the energy, the trade-off there between caring about the environment, or like overly caring about the environment, maybe.
Not like the EU.
Sorry. That's it. You can read all that on our website. And we'll go to our interviews now. But before we do, thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. And thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. You can subscribe on all of those, and you can make sure you're telling your friends and family about that so they can subscribe as well. And if you are listening on iTunes, be a mate, chuck us that 5-star review. And you can leave. Thank you. You can leave a comment, maybe a tip for the show, maybe what you like, maybe what you want to see more of in future. So yeah. That's really cool. Nina, I know it's the end of... Oh, and donate to our end of financial year once more. That is ipa.org.au/EOFY. But if people want a lasting commitment to the IPA, maybe a 12-month commitment, give or take, what can people do?
Well, just become a member. Just visit our website, that ipa.org.au, and click on that join button. And starting as low as $22, you can become the voice of one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia. Ooh, that's a lot.
No, it's a lot to become a member of the IPA, but not financially. So, yeah, we'll go to those interviews now. Okay, we're now joined for the first time by Stephen Globerman from the Fraser Institute. This is a really interesting conversation. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, so a bit of background here. So Stephen is the resident scholar and Addington Chair in Measurement at the Fraser Institute, as well as the Professor Emeritus at Western Washington University. You also co-authored the really interesting and important book, Demographics and Entrepreneurship, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population, in May this year. A book the IPA contributed to, but the Fraser Institute with a big force behind it, and you can download for free off the Fraser Institute website. So let's start there. This book talks about declining entrepreneurship in places like Canada and Australia. Why is entrepreneurship declining, and what's the solution?
Well, there are a variety of contributors, but the one that we focused on in particular, in part because it doesn't get a lot of attention, is the demographic profile of developed countries, specifically the aging of the population, which, as the book explains, contributes to declining rates of entrepreneurship. And the book goes on to discuss policies which indirectly also contribute to declining entrepreneurship and, if reversed, might help mitigate the effects of the aging population.
Terrific. Thanks for that, Stephen. We spoke to your colleague Jason Clemens a couple of weeks ago about this book, so we won't go into too much detail. But in particular, this impacts small businesses, isn't that correct?
Well, yes, because small businesses are disproportionately the startups, the entrepreneurs, if you will. This is not to say that innovation is exclusive to small businesses, but it's the small businesses that really generate the turnover in businesses that Schumpeter referred to in his creative destruction thesis.
So what is going to happen to economies around the world if small businesses continue to decline like this? What is that gap in entrepreneurship going to cause?
Well, what it's going to cause is decreasing rates of innovation in particular, and since innovation is the major contributor to increases in what economists call total factor productivity, which is essentially the productivity of all the conventional inputs used to produce output, a declining rate of growth of multi-factor productivity ultimately means slower rates of growth of living standards, real living standards.
All right, and so what are some of the solutions to this emerging problem?
Well, there are a number, but I think in terms of prioritizing, the tax structure is a potentially very important instrument to promote entrepreneurship and innovation more generally. And in particular, we focus on the capital gains tax and make the argument that one policymaker should be thinking about at the least significantly reducing capital gains taxes and indeed eliminating capital gains taxes, and as well reducing relatively high marginal rates of income taxes, which also act as a deterrent to people starting businesses and taking risks, which is the feature of entrepreneurship, taking risks to get in principle large financial gains. We also talk about regulation, and in particular labor market regulations and financial regulations, which may be certainly discouraging startups and inhibiting the financing of startups.
And red tape, of course, would be another issue. Is that right? That's something we do a lot of work with here at the IPA.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, brilliant. So let's move on to another area. So you've done a lot of work on free trade over your career. So this is a huge global issue at the moment, the idea of trade deficits and trade wars. And particularly, there seems to be a lot of conversation about where trade is between Canada and the US. Could you describe the dispute emerging between the US and Canada for Australia listeners? So what is behind this talk?
Well, I guess the biggest item in the background is NAFTA. And what's going to happen to NAFTA? Is it going to be renewed or is it not? And then what happens if it's not? And at the moment, my own bet is that the odds are now tilted in favor of not having a renewed NAFTA. And what does that mean for Canada? Well, what that means is, in principle, Canada and the U.S. would fall back to the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement that was put in place in 1989. But I think it's fair to infer that if Trump is not happy with NAFTA, and particularly not happy with the arrangements that Canada has under NAFTA, he's not going to be happy with the fallback to the Free Trade Agreement. And so where we would wind up is with the WTO tariffs in place between Canada and the U.S. Now, that by itself would not be a disaster for Canada because the U.S. WTO tariffs are relatively low on Canadian goods, one or two exceptions, and as well symmetrically, Canadian tariffs on U.S. goods are relatively low for most things except dairy products and poultry and that type of thing. But it's clear that Trump intends to use tariffs as an instrument to essentially do his trade negotiating, and then it's you know, all bets are off. We now have steel and aluminum tariffs which were levied against Canada. We have Canada levying countervailing tariffs against the U.S. in retaliation, and it's really very difficult to know where the ultimate equilibrium is here.
Right, very interesting. The other day, President Trump said that Canada treats us horribly on trade. Do you think that's fair?
I'm sorry, that it does. It doesn't do trade negotiations well.
He said the other day that he just said Canada treats us horribly on trade.
Well, he said that about just about every country. So I think the important point that should be noted, which Trump seems to either intentionally or unintentionally get wrong every single time he talks about this, is that the U.S. has a trade surplus with Canada. Canada has a trade surplus on goods, but the U.S. has an even larger trade surplus on services. And if that's the metric that Trump wants to use to measure whether another country is a good or bad trading partner, well, he should be quite happy with Canada. Of course, it makes no sense to use that as a metric of the benefits from trade, but if one does, then Canada is probably the U.S., one of the U.S.'s best trading partners.
So, just to confirm, you don't want to take this opportunity to apologize to President Trump on behalf of Canada?
No, I think it should be going the other way around.
Okay, well, fair enough. There's probably a tweet about to be tweeted at you quite quickly. But let's talk about another area that's really piqued a lot of our members' interest from Canada. Mm. So recently, the Doug Ford was elected as Premier of Ontario earlier this month. That sort of came out of left field. People weren't really predicting it a while ago. Why did he win, and what do you reckon that's going to have as an impact on Ontario and probably Canada as a whole?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure that I'm capable of giving an answer to that. The easy answer is to say that this populist move across the political landscape, not just in the U.S. and not just in Canada, but as you know, in Europe as well, that Ontario is now exhibiting the kinds of concerns that that contributed to its growth elsewhere. Except when you kind of look closely at what's happening, there's not quite the same pressure from immigration, for example, that's been pushing populist votes. The Ontario economy has not really suffered in a major way. There hasn't been a significant increase in unemployment. So there certainly is some pushback on the relatively high tax rates in Ontario, and the marginal tax rates, when you combine federal and provincial taxes, are the highest in Canada, and I think that's certainly something that people are concerned about, and as well high real estate prices in Toronto, and that may be indirectly related to immigration, may also be at work. But I have to say that I probably was as surprised as most anyone else by that result, although the Liberals, as I say, the Liberals were under pressure because of the tax rates, the economy not declining, but certainly not growing as fast as people were expecting and hoping for.
What about Doug Ford's kind of economic credentials? What are his economic policies like, and how will they impact what you're talking about in your book, which is entrepreneurship?
Well, if he follows through with the platform that he was running on, then it seems reasonable to expect some reduction in tax rates, some reduction in regulations, and those initiatives would be in the right direction in terms of promoting entrepreneurship and broadly promoting economic growth. The worry that I would have is that he might move in the same direction as President Trump, which is to really become an activist in economic policy, which is not what we want. We want the market to determine economic transactions, not a president making pronouncements about what any company can do or not do, or else they'll find themselves in trouble with the leader.
Cool. Okay, so last question. So just on this Doug Ford thing, so obviously that was a pretty embarrassing loss for Justin Trudeau. How many social causes should he now throw himself into in an effort to win back some voters, do you reckon?
Well, I wouldn't recommend that's the direction he take. I think that Canada is at a very significant economic crossroads, in danger of having the bilateral relationship, that is the relationship with the U.S., which has really been the basis for Canada's economic international economic policies. The danger is that's quicksand now. It's disappearing under the feet of the Canadian politicians. What Canada really should be doing is focusing on leveraging and revitalizing international trade with other trading partners, get the free trade agreement with Europe really up and running, get the new Trans-Pacific Partnership up and running. That's what I think he should be concentrating on.
It might be a tough sell to him, because I don't know if GQ is writing too many articles about international trade policy. But anyway, Stephen, thank you so much for your time. The book, once again, is Demographics and Entrepreneurship, Mitigating the Effects of an Aging Population. You can download it for free on the Fraser Institute website. Stephen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Okay, we are now joined once again by one of our favourites here, the IPA's research fellow, Matthew Lesh. Matthew, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. I always do wonder, who are your not favourites?
We can't legally discuss that pending the latest lawsuit.
We get told
us
to big everyone up. So.
Okay.
I feel like it's been a busy week for Matt.
It has been a busy week. So let's talk about it. So on Tuesday this week, you have published our latest parliamentary research brief. For new listeners to the show or new people to the IPA, parliamentary research briefs are something we put out every few weeks and we deliver them to all federal politicians who are on a cause that is really specific to that week's events or that week's what people are thinking about. And it sort of puts forward a good policy position or good philosophical position that the government should get around.
So, which we control, by the way.
As the puppet masters. Yeah, it's basically just our morning talking points. But let's talk about this one. So this week's was from Matthew, 3.55 million workers will benefit from enterprise tax number two. So let's start with that. What is the enterprise tax plan?
Do you mean enterprise?
Maybe. What did I say?
Enterprise.
Oh, good Lord. All right.
So the enterprise tax plan number two is the coalition's plan to reduce corporate taxation from 30% to 25% for all companies over the period of 2019 to 2027. So in the scheme of things, it is not the most ambitious tax plan. So obviously Trump in 1 year reduced corporate tax in the US from something like 35% to 21%.
Yep.
But it is certainly a step in the right direction. And the current debate they're having in the Senate is whether or not that it should be extended to businesses with over 50 million employees. And what our research has found with some new statistics from the ABS is that 3.55 million workers will work in companies with over $50 million in revenue. It's about a third of all workers. Large companies are some of the biggest growth in terms of employment. They are the ones that we really do need to encourage to invest. They're already, in fact, the ones that are paying the most tax. So one of the fascinating things that I found when you actually do look at the Australian Tax Office statistics is that you have a small number of companies. So you have about 2,500 companies of 940,000 companies in Australia pay almost $250 billion in tax. So they are 0.33% of companies paying 63% of all tax between 2011 and 2016. So this idea that like big companies aren't paying enough tax is an absolute myth. And that we should really be encouraging big companies to grow and prosper over time, because these are the companies that are going to be ultimately providing products that benefit Australian consumers and jobs that benefit workers.
Give that stat again for our listeners, because that's amazing.
So just 0.33% of companies pay 63% of company tax revenues.
And so these are the people that are meant to not be paying their fair share.
Well, I don't think they are paying their fair share by those statistics.
Hey!
So,
that's cool.
Yeah. So this is as I understand it, this hasn't passed yet. What do you reckon the odds are of it passing, or do you reckon like a more watered down version is probably going to get up?
So it's not precisely clear what the government will be able to negotiate through the Senate. So Labor previously said they would oppose this tax plan, so that puts up a great barrier. The Greens oppose it. In fact, Bill Shorten came up this week to say not only does he oppose the current tax plan, but he wants to actually roll back previous legislated tax reductions for companies with over $10 million in revenue. So if you look at the stats on companies with over $10 million in revenue, that's about 5.5 million Australian employees. That's almost half of all workers will be worse off under Labor's plan compared to the coalition's plan. The government may need to, for example, there was discussion today that in order to get Darren Hinch on side, they'd have to set a $500 million turnover level. Now, that's obviously not ideal to have a differentiated tax system, but it's better than, I suppose, no reduction at all. I mean, fundamentally, I think if you're going to...
I think if you want to get Darren Hinch on side, you just have a cameraman, just follow him around all day, and then it'll just do whatever you want. If he's like, oh, I'm being filmed? Okay, well, what are we talking about?
Very important, very important. Unfortunately, I think Darren Hinch has gone a bit soft in his time in the Senate. I remember him back in the day in Melbourne radio, he always used to be a little bit more, you know, hard and aggressive on these things. But
you've got to fill out 3 hours of content on Melbourne radio.
That's true.
There's a demand. It's just not there in the Australian Senate.
Exactly. He must be feeling a bit unheard, so he needs to stick up his hand. But I mean, fundamentally here, it's a question of should different size companies pay a different level of tax? And it doesn't really make any sense in my head to have a discriminatory tax system that treats companies that are doing well worse. So usually when government sets out to create policy, they create policy which incentivizes people to succeed and to do better. In this case, they basically say to companies, oh, we want you to do well, but not too well. And if you start doing too well, we're going to tax you really highly. Now, I think the incentives need to be completely reversed, and we should be encouraging companies of all sizes to grow by not taxing at certain arbitrary levels of their turnover.
Yeah, I think by reverse you mean like a flat tax across all systems. I mean, it's not like just, you know, throw the book at small businesses. Like, why aren't you?
No. come on, small businesses. Yeah. You need to grow. I mean, they do need to grow, and they can grow with lower taxes. But also, big businesses should be encouraged to grow as well. And it's quite a new phenomenon to have differentiated corporate taxation levels in Australia. This was something that I think is quite unfortunately that the Abbott Turnbull government began.
Okay.
And now Labor's obviously wants to grab onto this differentiated tax ideas as well. Thankfully, the current government is trying to get rid of this over time, but it's quite a bad precedent, I think, to set to have a differentiated taxation levels for corporates.
So there's like a cultural issue here, isn't there? Because as you said, like a big business is just a small business that was successful. And we like to bag big businesses as much as anyone, don't we, James?
Yes.
It's one of our favourite things, but they're not all bad and, you know,
They're not all bad when they're creating products that people buy and people want to use. They are bad, and we should be concerned about big businesses when they only exist because of regulation and red tape. That means that small businesses can't compete, and then you have an unfair playing field. But fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with a business being big and successful.
Fair enough. So the culture sort of extends probably past Australian Parliament House. So we get the idea, like in Parliament, it's like, the you know, no one loves to be on the side of big businesses. But when it does get into the press, it's always talking about Liberals siding up to the big end of town and Labor trying to carry to the big end of town. Why are concerns that this is doing favours for big business, and so the hysteria around the media that creates, why is that so ridiculous to you? And where do you think that comes from?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of community disquiet about larger businesses. In terms of, you see quite a lot of concern that big businesses are too close to government. It's probably true. Big businesses too close to regulators, and they do end up with the regulation in their own benefit, which to an extent is also true. And that's something really that the public choice economists have pointed out for quite a while, that when businesses get too big, they will seek advantages from government. Now, in my head, it's ultimately the responsibility of politicians to resist and not to fall to special interests.
Yep.
Of any kind, be it the trade unions as the special interest trying to push for special situations in workplace law that benefits trade unions, be it progressive advocacy groups trying to push for their own interest, or be it for businesses. It's the role of politicians to be able to resist that. And I think often perhaps governments have been too willing to be work with, at least quietly behind the scenes, work with big business in a not very productive way, I suppose, for the economy at large. So I think, in a sense, the politicians probably have themselves to blame to an extent for community disquiet about big business. So I think some of the relationships you've seen come out of the Royal Commission into banking between the banks and the regulator are genuinely quite concerning. And that's the result. This is kind of the natural result you get when you have these independent regulators who are mandated to take their and create policy in, I guess, collaboration with the businesses. They're naturally going to end up taking the business's side perhaps more than they should in the way they regulate, and create advantages for those businesses that ultimately benefit the existing players and make competition very difficult. So in Australia, we have the Big Four banking policy, so that it's very hard for a new bank to establish, just because the mountains and mountains of regulation and compliance and whatnot you have to go through to get there.
So where do we sit in comparison with other countries around the world with our business tax rate?
Well, so Australia now has one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. So in the 90s, Australia was actually reducing corporate tax ahead of the world. So we reduced our corporate tax rate down from about 49% to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And then it basically hasn't really changed since then, except for smaller businesses. So in the US, you've now, as I said, you've got down to 21%. In Britain, particularly under the Cameron Conservative government, they reduced corporate tax to 19%.
Yep.
Singapore has 17%. Hong Kong is 16.5%. So, I mean, the real danger of that, it's quite arbitrary in a sense, just a, you know, random number, but the danger is that if you're a company, a multinational company, and you're deciding where to invest your money, the amount of corporate tax you have to pay is a factor in that. And it can be the marginal factor that means, well, I'll set up my business in Singapore because they've got a low tax, friendly environment for businesses, and I'm not going to bother coming to Australia and investing in this Australian project or option. So there is a quite substantial danger in terms of international and foreign investment. And there was also a recent paper out this week by the RBA that looked at, so during the back in the what were once viewed as the good old days of the Rudd years, during the stimulus package, one of the elements was a temporary tax concession for corporate tax rates. And what the RBA paper found is they estimated that for every 10 10% worth of tax break, there was a 33% increase in business investment, which is huge. And really, more business investment means more technology, more R&D that pushes up productivity and pushes up wages. So investment isn't everything, but investment is absolutely essential in the long term, almost is everything in terms of raising living standards. So the more you do lower corporate tax rates, the ultimately you get more investment, you get higher wages, and you get more jobs.
Very cool. That parliamentary research brief is available on our website if you want to learn some more about it. And it was also covered on the front page of The Australian, I want to say.
Yes.
Yes, very cool. So you can also read that. So let's change tracks for a little bit and talk about something else. So another story that came out this week was Coke and Pepsi, two massive competitors, have agreed to slash sugar content in their drinks. And it's like the sort of plastic bags thing where it's they're doing it independently, but there is a threat of ongoing regulation of down the line there might be a sugar tax brought in. So Matthew, one thing that you saw this week was the New Zealand government reviewed 47 peer-reviewed studies about the sugar tax and whether or not it actually does harm consumption. And conclusions are scathing. So they found a lot of things. Now, I thought this was really interesting. Matthew, what did you reckon of it?
So the basic sum of what the New Zealand, meta study found was that, yes, it is...
We love studies.
We love
big academic guys.
There's a few studies that show that.
Mm. There's a lot of studies that show that people like studies. Might be some bias there. Anyway, so what it found is that, increasing the price of sugary soft drinks through a tax will slightly reduce consumption of those soft drinks. But that's only the first order impact. What you also have to then consider is, does it reduce consumption enough to have an impact on obesity? And the New Zealand study and kind of logic will tell you it's probably not. So because, and this is a statistic from the ABS, because only 4% of an Australian's total calorie intake is from soft drinks, a sugar tax will not actually have, even if people do reduce their consumption slightly, will not have an impact on the person's obesity. And the reason for that is because even if they do slightly reduce it, their intake, they can always just substitute to other unhealthy foods. So a sugar tax doesn't stop people from having more chocolate bars or sugary juices or whatever other consumption they so choose. So often a study will come out and say, oh yeah, there's an impact of a sugar tax and it does reduce consumption, but then it doesn't actually prove that small reduction in consumption has any impact on obesity. So all it really does is push up cost of living, particularly for low-income people who will spend more of their money on sugary soft drinks and will spend a greater proportion of their money on sugary soft drinks. So this is a tax that will hit poor people hard and will not have any impact on obesity.
Science is settled, James.
Absolutely. Sorry, I want to ask you two follow-ups, Matthew. Do you reckon there's any possible link to the fact that corn syrup is a pretty cheap substitute for sugar that these companies could start embracing in a way? Call me a cynic, but maybe they're also thinking with their hip pockets a little.
I suspect that they're thinking with their PR minds as well as their hip pockets. So they haven't actually said how they're going to achieve this. They haven't said that if they're actually going to change the recipe of Coke and Pepsi, the main products, or if they're going to kind of introduce other low sugar options. So I have no philosophical issue whatsoever with Coke and Pepsi responding to market demand and the knowledge that, yes, you shouldn't have too much sugar and providing alternative products. Now, are those alternative products healthy, unhealthy in other ways because they use a lot of artificial sweeteners, potentially?
Yeah, there's I don't have any statistics to back this up. There is no way Coke Zero is healthier for you than regular Coke.
It's not a peer-reviewed take from James.
I think it would really depend on the particular balance, I suppose, between whatever they're using to artificially sweeten, is that better or worse than natural sugar? Which I'm not a health doctor kind of person to be honest. That's precisely. I suppose they think in their head there's some benefit. This is the problem when a government policy starts focusing on one incentive change, like one thing they want to try to achieve, and then that leads to bad outcomes in other areas. The unintended consequences are always so high and so furious whenever government tries to achieve one outcome. It really does often have unintended consequences.
My concern is that the froth companies are going to get together and start reducing alcohol.
That would be a dark day for Peter Gregory.
I'm going to pack up and go home when that happens.
Well, Peter, I have some good news for you, which is there's one study in the US that found that as a result of an increased sugar tax, people substituted to more beer.
Do they?
So sugar taxes may mean more beer. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily what they wanted, but that could be a potential outcome.
And I think if they reduce the alcoholic content of beers, then the obvious solution is to just drink more beers, which I think, Pete, I think you have that in you.
Yep. Well, look.
I believe
pre-season's been good.
I don't drink much Coke anyway.
All right.
Or much beer because my body's my temple.
Good Lord. So. What God is out of temple to you? Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on the show. The parliamentary research brief is on our website if you guys want to read it.
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries.
Thanks, mate.
Okay, thank you to Steve Globerman and Lesh for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So let's run through some stories that have made us laugh this week. Pete, hit us off, mate.
Well, if you read Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday, you would have realised that I loved this story from The Drum on Wednesday night. The editor of the Saturday paper, Eric Jensen, said, and I quote, "It's good." So of Shorten's tax cuts. Sorry, reversal of tax cuts. "It's good policy. This should be sold as Shorten recoups $20 billion in missing government revenues. There isn't an economist anywhere in the world that thinks giving tax cuts to big business stimulates the economy. It's a lie."
Name one.
Isn't an economist.
Name one economist that thinks lowering taxes helps
anywhere
things.
Anywhere in the world. First thing I'd say in Eric's...
Where's the light?
I wish the people out there could see James's facial expression.
I don't. I would not wish that on anyone.
It's very belligerent. Firstly, in Eric's defense, he does appear to be quite hungover in this thing.
Yeah, look, this is the thing. Like, it's an audio podcast. Well, I hope. No cameras around here.
Well,
I can see.
I don't know.
This is an audio podcast and this is a visual joke, but good golly. This guy needs to suit up for TV.
Yep.
Pause this podcast if you're listening at home. Go to the ABC Drum Twitter feed.
Yep.
The tweet is from the 27th of June and just see this bloke for all it's worth.
Or click on it in Hey Yesterday.
Oh, yes. That's also true.
And he sort of goes on and says a few other things all about how, you know, another quote, "There isn't any evidence anywhere in the world of tax cuts actually stimulating the economy." Okay. It's an interesting call. And he says, of his economist thing, this guy comes in, this other economist from somewhere comes in and goes, "I don't think that's true, Eric." And he goes...
Oh, so we found the economist. we just stopped. It just says here.
He might not be an economist.
There's not an economist anywhere in the world.
I should know, but I don't know if he was an economist or not. Anyway, he says,
That was a panic.
"Unless your laffer drawing curves on napkins or something." So, you know, only someone who changed the world, but okay. And then Anne Henderson was also on the program from the Sydney Institute, and she had a great response, which I won't go through, but as he was just sort of tailing off, you could hear her whispering into the microphone, "Rubbish." Like, she literally says rubbish and you can hear it. It's really funny.
That's very cool. I do like when he says, "unless you're laughing drawing things like on napkins," where it's like, if you just remove everything that proves me wrong, you'll find that I'm right.
Yeah.
If you remove all the evidence.
Just laugher.
Yeah.
Just laugher.
Just laugher.
Advised Reagan.
Look, Adam Smith, you know, whatever. cool. Sorry. Yeah, that was a good one. I'll move on to one of mine once I find it. Sorry. This story is Twitter in a nutshell, and one of those ones that will turn you into a Luddite. So people who are active on Twitter might have heard of the Racism Watchdog Twitter account.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a Twitter account that sort of just quote tweets examples of thinly veiled racism, or how it perceives to be thinly veiled racism.
Yep.
And then it's a picture of a dog and it just tweets woof, woof, woof. As in, like, I found some racism.
It's meant to identify like a dog whistle.
Yeah, yeah. So, woof, woof. There was like one where it's like, there was like a Ben Shapiro tweet saying, like, if you don't have your pants pulled all the way up and you've got them, like, you know, hunched over, then you won't get anywhere in life. And they were like, woof, woof, woof.
Yep.
So that's the kind of deal. But they ran into a bit of hot water this week. So they linked to an article about a black woman punching white passengers while screaming, "I hate white people."
And they did woof.
Sounds like racism watchdogs bread and butter. They quote tweet that. They say, woof, woof, woof.
Do it again.
Woof, woof, woof.
Thank you.
How's this not Pete speaking truth to power? But anyway, like this just looks like any racism watchdog tweet, but they made one terrible mistake. They tweeted out an article about a black woman.
Yeah.
And as they were told by many of their commenters, racism, and it was actually bigotry, prejudice, not racism. Because racism involves systematic racial oppression, an issue not faced by white Americans. So already this is annoying me. And then it gets worse. Racism watchdogs shut down their account.
Yeah.
They
deleted the tweet.
Yeah, running the account is an emotional labor that we're not cut out to do every day. # self-care is important. Oh. So they're gone. They're not coming back.
No, the stress of putting a dog on the internet.
Woof, woof, woof. Got too much of them.
Well, as Andrew Bushnell sort of brought this to our attention and said, if this doesn't want to make you a misanthropic Luddite, I don't know what does.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is why no one will be on Twitter in 3 years.
It's like it's. I mean, it's
the most 2018 story I could possibly come up with. You've got a dog on the internet. You've got woof 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 being a proxy for a political argument.
Yep.
And then you've got hashtag self care.
Yeah. I need to take some time out. And it's. I mean, you always like to see, you know, confected outrage merchants become the victim of confected outrage. That's one of my very favorite things.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is funny on that basis.
On that basis. Let's move on to another one, Pete.
Right. Okay, let's do Woolworths because we've been talking about plastic bags a bit and I got Woolworthed the other night.
What is Woolworth?
I forgot to take a bag.
Oh, is that Woolworth now?
Well, I just made it up. Oh, well. And then...
What did I make up?
Elbow Momentum.
Yeah, Elbow Momentum. Yep. We can have one each.
Okay.
One each per show.
Okay, that's good. That means I have to think of one every week, but okay. and I turned up and obviously didn't have a bag. So I had to buy one for 99 cents.
99?
Yep.
Oh, I thought it was 50 cents.
I don't know.
Oh, he got double Woolworths. Yeah. He got absolutely taken sure over a barrel.
Though. Maybe it was 50 cents. And so, but anyway, Woolworths have announced today, or yesterday even, that because of the outrage from their customers that they now have to pay for bags, that they're going to give away these free bags for 10 days. So I'd like to give you a few facts about these bags, which we haven't covered before. Do you realise, James and Nina, that you have to use this plastic bag, these bags, which are plastic, by the way, but are thicker plastic, 50 to 100 times to accrue an environmental benefit over the normal plastic bag?
So 100 times?
50 to 100.
50 to 100?
Yep.
So use that particular plastic bag before just free reusable bags?
Yep. So if you chuck that out and buy a new one...
Or just forget it and then get a second one, which I plan on doing.
Which I do all the time.
Yep.
Like I literally
my house
just did
that. Might, like in 6 months' time, my house might just be these reusable plastic bags.
There you go.
Like that's just it.
Yeah.
Like I have to tell some of my roommates, I'll have to move out. We need more storage space for the bags.
I find it so hard to believe that blokes in their early 20s would forget something like that when they go shopping. But yeah, so that is... Like, so they're now literally giving out bags which are like 50 times worse for the environment for free.
Yeah, but... They for 24 hours got to feel nice about themselves on Twitter.
That's right. And as so,
can you put a price on that? I don't think.
They literally put the price on it because they wanted to obviously save money.
Yes.
So it's funny now that it's costing them money, and I hope it gets really bad and they have to change their mind.
Yeah. If we go back to free reusable bags, if we go back to free single use plastic bags, that'll be hilarious.
Yeah. Nana, you got a lot of feelings about this.
Do I?
Yeah, you do. You do.
Yeah, let me just make sure
this is in your wheelhouse. This is in your straw wheelhouse.
Yeah. I used to be in the straw, now I'm in there.
Yeah, Nina's expanding. Yeah, expanding the portfolio.
She's the
director of all plastic related matches.
She's the IPA's director of
this
kind of stuff.
I actually hate that plastic bag.
Oh, here we go.
I don't know why. I can't use it for anything. It's too thick for anything.
Too many new ones or old ones.
Big. And I always forget about it. Since they tried to change it to these ones instead of a single-use one, I haven't been to Woolies like spontaneously. I used to go there.
You used to love your spontaneous
I used to go there just like randomly just to grab, snacks and whatever.
Yeah.
But now because you need to have that plastic bag, I don't want to pay extra cents for it.
Yeah.
I didn't even go there.
Well, there you go, Woolworths.
But like there that's going to be a market cost of everything.
You lost a customer
everything.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah. You lost a great customer.
Yeah.
Do you know another thing? Gideon Rosner told me something this morning. Gideon is full of useful information. This was actually Lesh. Gideon told me the earlier stuff. Lesh told me this. Apparently there's a health
Gideon,
issue.
You're still Which at a great place one? Of information.
Yeah. What's that?
Gideon's still a great source of information.
Yeah. Well, he gave me that other
Regardless
stuff.
Regardless of this or not.
They've all been great. But apparently, they've done some study in San Francisco that they've worked out that plastic bags are actually better for your health because if you use the same bag again and again and again, there's more bacteria. And they actually found...
Oh, yeah. Dad blogged about this. There's like deaths.
Oh, really?
Like you can get food
there
poisoning.
You go. Well,
yeah.
I thought I was breaking this story, but obviously...
Sorry.
Australia's most popular columnist
beat me to it. Can you actually wash it?
Yeah.
Can you actually wash it?
Yeah, but like...
Yeah, but... Look, you know, is James going to wash it? Yeah, look at this guy.
I don't wash myself.
It's not dishwasher safe, isn't it?
I don't know. Scarlett is saying no. Our work experience person. Hi, Scarlett.
Hi, Scarlett. There we go.
She hasn't got a microphone.
just
Anyway.
This is how to host a podcast. So make sure you're taking copious notes.
That's plastic bags.
All right, cool. Let's move on to the last story I've got. This is coming out this morning. I think it is. So Peter Alexander, brand. Well, I just felt, you know.
Yeah,
you've done some hard yards. I'll come in and help you out.
Good stuff.
Peter Alexander, big brand, big fashion brand about pajamas in Australia, has removed a boys' jumper emblazoned with the slogan, "Boys will be boys," from the market after concerned parents complained about the use of the phrase. So we had one person here who came forward complaining about the phrase.
Yep.
The quote is, boys will be held accountable for their actions. I hate to see an Australian store who makes such great pajamas put such a sexist statement on a t-shirt intended for young boys. Excusing boys of their behaviour is not a step in the right direction. It's 2018. Anytime you end an argument with it's 2018, I just hope you lose that argument. Even if it's right. Even if you're right. If you end it with it's 2018, I'm on the other side.
What's so good about 2018?
Nothing.
Richard's on top of the ladder.
I like 2018. It's much
better.
What's
that name, sorry?
Your plastic bag? That's a 2018.
Oh, yeah. Oh, guys, he's wrong. Reusable plastic bags. It's 2018.
No economist thinks we should cut taxes.
Yeah, it's 2018. We're over cutting taxes.
What?
Actually, it's kind of addictive. I'm going to start ending every argument with segment. It's 2018.
This is a segment.
It's 2018.
Anyway, boys will not be boys.
So
is that what she wants?
I don't know what she... Well, so boys will be boys. It's now become... When people talk about sexual assault in Australia, it's now the idea that, like, if you say boys will be boys, then that is butterfly effect thing into you condone everything that terrible that happens, which is not true. And I don't get it.
What annoys me about this is that,
person right here.
And I know this is meant to be the funny section of the show, but this lets people off. Like, if you say the reason why people abuse people is because it's society and it's stuff like a pajama top, that means violent offenders can sort of, it sort of lets them off the hook for their terrible...
society almost.
Yeah, it's like, no, they behave terribly, they're violent people.
Awful people.
And that's whose fault, they're responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
So that's what annoys me about this stuff.
Indeed. Cool, so that's it for the show this week. Thank you. Oh, actually, one more thing. So Pete, our former soccer expertly predicting the end of the, a lot of things. So Australia has come to... I was going to say an untimely end to the Socceroos, but it seemed to be very timely.
Yeah.
Now, John has been walking up and down the office. Executive Director John Roscombe has been walking up and down the office talking about how Australia played gutlessly and we're the only team that hasn't shown up to the World Cup.
Yes.
Germany might have something to say about that. But Pete, what do you reckon about Australia's performance?
Well, firstly, I'd say, you know, John and Bushnell know a lot about soccer. I wouldn't claim to be the IPA's foremost expert, but I probably know more than you, so that's why
Your desk head would say otherwise.
Okay. Anyway, so... Where Johnny's coming from with that is Craig Foster, after Australia got knocked out, who's an SBS analyst, absolutely cut sick and said, you know, this coach was too defensive. We played gutlessly because we're meant to be attacking. That's our national attitude, blah, 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 which I kind of empathise with. But at the end of the day, our players aren't very good.
No.
And that's why we didn't win.
Okay, cool. That is a good place to end the show. So thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. And thank you too, Steve Globeman from the Fraser Institute and Matthew Lesh from the IPA, from like two doors down.
Yep. Contractually obliged.
Yeah, but I like to think they wanted to. Cool. So thank you to them for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, through our Hey What Did I Miss email. So make sure you subscribe. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about it. If you are listening on iTunes, make sure to leave a 5-star review. Really helps us out with the ratings and does give you the option to leave a comment for the show. EOFY campaign. Man, I've lost it at the end here.
What is Nina doing?
What am I doing? I'm like just waving some piece of equipment around like a mad dictator. Cool. So end of financial year campaign. Last day to donate. So you can donate at ipa.org.au/EOFY. You can really help us out. Become keep being Australia's voice for freedom in Australia. But Nina, if people want to make a lasting commitment to the IPA, how can they become a member?
Well, just visit our website at ipa.org.au and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Huge. All right. See you guys next week.
Stay up.